Hi, I'm Brian Elliott, founder of the Good Brain Digital Studios, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. The startup story would not be possible if it wasn't for the support of our sponsor, MoboCash. Move money like a miracle with MoboCash, the free money app that kicks cash. Download MoboCash app on iTunes or Google Play today, and you'll get your slick new Mobo card in the mail. You are no longer dependent upon digital currency alone, but you'll have a card that allows you to purchase at POS stations, restaurants, buy online, anywhere that you want to use your money. No credit check, no credit impact, quick direct deposit, FDIC insured, and free to register and activate. Support our sponsor, MoboCash. Visit mobo.cash or thestartupstory.co/mobocash.
So I'm just going to be honest with you. We're a new podcast, so we don't have a lot of episodes in the pipeline. So I can't avoid recording these intros when it comes to being sick. So I apologize ahead of time if I sound nasally or I sound like I'm in a tunnel or I just don't sound like my normal self. I'm battling a cold right now, but nevertheless, the show must go on. And like I said, The Startup Story is a new podcast, so we don't really have all the demographics of our listeners nailed down just yet. That said, if you're 30 years or older, then you remember the Great Recession and the impact it had. From the years 2007 to 2010, layoff announcements were a regular occurrence, and finding employment was close to impossible if you were seeking a new job. During the years of the Great Recession, like I said, 07 and 2012, one-third of small businesses less than 5 years old closed their doors. It was an incredibly challenging time for many. That said, our guest today started a digital studio company at the very beginning of the greatest recession in U.S. history. Our guest is Brian Elliott, the founder of Good Brain Digital Studios and creator of the video series Behind the Brand. During Good Brain's infancy, Brian realized that in order to set himself apart from the numerous other digital studios, he was going to have to create content around the stories he wanted to tell. In doing so, he ended up surrounding himself with some of the most powerful names in business. People like Tony Robbins and Seth Godin, Cesar Millan and Gary Vaynerchuk, just to name a few. In this episode, you're going to hear how important it is to seek input and guidance from those who are farther down the road than you are. You will see how critical it is to adapt your business plan to accommodate your market. And even sometimes that means relocating your business entirely. You will hear firsthand how it pays to take risks in a challenging economy, especially when others might be playing it safe. You see, during the Great Recession, Brian made an entirely new path for himself that positioned him outside the commoditized marketplace for videographers. Were there moments in Brian's journey that were frightening and somewhat unclear? Yeah, of course there were. And you will hear about those during this episode. But you'll also hear is the startup story of a founder who had such resilience in the face of hardships. You will hear the startup story of a founder that knew what he was fully capable of and refused to allow the external circumstances of, well, a global economic meltdown deter him from building his dreams. What makes Brian's startup story so remarkable is that while the early days of his life showed signs of entrepreneurship, he was forced to learn everything on his own and without a whole lot of guidance.
As a kid, I definitely had that lemonade stand. I traded baseball cards, like Gary Vee talks about trading baseball cards. I did lots of different entrepreneurial activities, and I was always sort of the reluctant leader of my group. For some reason, I'm somewhat introverted, actually very introverted when you get to know me better. But for whatever reason, I always got kind of pushed to the front of the line to talk to the adults, and I always felt kind of comfortable talking to adults. You know, and kids my own age at that. But yeah, I was always sort of in some sort of leadership. I wanted to be out front. I was never walking in the back of the pack. Yeah. Now I'm thinking about my buddy Cesar Millan, who talks about pack mentality. Are you in the front, the middle, or the back? I was definitely in the front, even though I'm somewhat introverted.
Okay. What about your parents? Were they entrepreneurs?
So I have a longer story about my parents. So I'm adopted.
Okay.
And when my mom adopted me, I was just a couple of days old. Her marriage to my dad only lasted a few years. Okay. And then they split. And then she was married again a few years later and divorced again and then married again a few years later. And so I grew up as a latchkey kid.
Okay.
I had a good childhood. I had grandparents who were very loving. But I don't look back on my childhood in my parents as having given me very much guidance. Mm-hmm. And I sort of was left to figure stuff out on my own. I didn't grow up with a dad. And so that's totally regrettable. Actually, probably made me a better dad because of it, because I wanted to, you know, maybe not overcorrect, but like correct to the point where I wanted to do it differently.
Yeah.
But no one really gave me much guidance. I was very much trying to figure out on my own.
Do you think that has played a role in your entrepreneurial journey? The figuring things out and the pursuit to try and figure things out?
Yeah, it's definitely a pattern for sure. I think in my life, it can be summed up as sink or swim. And I've decided to swim most of the time, at least. And yeah, I think that probably set the tone for things to come later for sure.
So in your high school years, I mean, obviously the lemonade stand, the baseball cards, depending on your age, maybe even Pogs. Like in episode one, I had a chance to sit down with Jason McCann, Veridesk, and you know, he talked about Pogs. And I was, man, that took me back for sure.
Yeah, so, Jason's a good dude.
He is a great guy, So when, in your high school years, what did you see for yourself? What was your path?
Yeah, I was thinking about going into medicine, actually, because I really enjoyed helping people. I was an athlete growing up. You know, I played football and baseball, I played varsity baseball, varsity football, I played recreational basketball. I played a year of soccer, and I regret quitting soccer at the high school level because it was probably my strongest sport.
Okay.
The high school I went to, the entire soccer team, this is when soccer wasn't that popular, only spoke Spanish. The coach spoke Spanish, and every single one of the players, except I was the only non-Spanish-speaking player.
Where'd you grow up? What city was this?
I grew up, went to high school in like the Placentia, Yorba Linda area.
Okay, yeah. So northern Orange County.
North Orange County, yeah. I was born in Los Angeles, lived in the San Fernando Valley for many years, and then moved down to Orange County for my high school years.
Got it.
So I quit the team, and that was a huge mistake because I had some skill in soccer, but I felt like, you know, an outsider. I couldn't understand what everyone was saying, and at the time, you know, I didn't know any better, and so... Yeah. But I was an athlete, and I was interested in, you know, how the body works, and I was interested in sports. I didn't have this illusion that I was going to play pro baseball or pro football based on my size, although I was the starting kicker, second string receiver, and cornerback, and I had a pretty good career as a kicker there.
Yeah.
I just didn't have parents who told me, hey, you should go, maybe you can get a college scholarship. Yeah. Or if that works out, who knows? It could lead to something bigger and better. I didn't have that guidance. And so I guess fell back on the idea that I'll just get a regular job and, you know, do something like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So medicine is a passion, helping, you know, there's obviously some things about the idea of medicine that I can see just from my experience with you, just the idea of helping individuals and serving people. So I can see a thread there. Along that journey, though, obviously you are going to college. You want to be in medicine. You're going to college. When did you know that medicine's not it?
Pretty quickly, I guess, because I wasn't that good at school. I was very impatient, and I was kind of bored with most things. And particularly in math and science, I wasn't very strong. And so I was like,
you kind of need those for medicine.
although, you know, where I was strong in school was English and writing. And maybe that was a little bit of the foreshadowing of what was to come, and you know, in being more of a journalist mentality or publishing stuff. I loved to write, and I was decent at speaking in front of people. I didn't have that kind of shyness or that, like, I would rather die than do public speaking attitude. So I guess that was my fallback. And I also considered teaching because I love teaching as well. And I thought about teaching at the college level because I just thought, like, that's the level that seems like everyone's really, it's a springboard into your career versus, and maybe this is unfair, I have kids, but for me as a high school student looking at younger kids, I was like, oh, that's just babysitting.
Yeah.
You know, like, because I'm sort of, you know, like that right now. And I, you know, I wouldn't want to teach some at the high school level. I'd want to go more aspire up and teach college. Yeah. So for right or wrong, that was my attitude.
I know at some point in your journey, you're with an advertising agency, a marketing agency.
Yeah. So as I started doing more writing, I saw opportunities in advertising and marketing. And so I sort of, I guess, gravitated towards that area. And I ended up getting a business degree from Pepperdine. I went to Pepperdine University. No football team, bummer. Or else maybe I would have, you know, tried out for the place kicker or something like that. I could kick a mean field goal still today. But yeah, I wanted to go into something that I could use my writing and creativity. I felt very creative more than I did analytical, right? There was two paths. There was the finance or marketing, yeah, and I went the marketing path. And right out of college, actually, I got a chance to work for Universal Pictures. So it was kind of like my first real big job. I did some other little jobs in between, tried little things here and there. But my first kind of big job was at Universal Pictures. And they gave me a shot to work in brand marketing and strategy. And that's really where I think I cut my teeth on a lot of this stuff that I talk about now with people who are doing big things.
What... In your time at Universal, what were some of the things you look back on fondly that kind of set you up for what was to come?
There's a lot. There's a ton. I learned so much there. I mean, as a brand manager, you know, I had a $30 million P&L. And back in the day, we were buying... The whole department is about 250 people at the time. So I don't want you to get the idea that I was, you know, managing everything. There's several different people doing... lots of different projects. But, you know, as a brand manager, you have access to a whole advertising team who then also is connected with the agency of record. You have a whole PR team internally that's then connected to outside PR agencies. Yeah. You have creative services. So in a way, you're sort of like this orchestra conductor conducting musicians who are like the best in the business, right? And so I had the advantage of learning a little bit from each of them, right? So PR, I learned all about PR from, you know, some really great people and the agencies that we contracted with. Advertising, same thing. We were buying upfront TV. So I learned all about, you know, buying media. We would take over, you know, do internet campaigns. So I learned a little bit about digital as it was coming of age. This was like 1999-ish, to give you context. And the internet was just a couple of years old, you know, and then content production. So what really I think was the spark that got to me to where I am now is I found myself in studio. Remember the time when we used to buy DVDs?
Yes.
And we would put them in our house and display them like, you know, we were proud to have movies. So that was the era that I was working at Universal, and Universal has a ton of great catalog, and we were... basically, as an industry trying to justify the high cost of DVDs. They were $19 or $24.99 or, you know, for a double pack. And, you know, movies like Gladiator or Meet the Parents or like Shrek was out. We were distributing DreamWorks at the time. And so we're like, how do we still get this much money for a DVD that really costs us less than a dollar to replicate, right?
Yeah.
And we thought, okay, we should do added value, right? Bonus material. So... again, as an industry, we invented things like the director's commentary or bloopers, alternative endings.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I found myself flying out to like New York, and I'm in a studio with Robert De Niro, and we're sitting down, and you know, I'm next to a camera. Of course, there's lots of other people.
Yeah.
I didn't do it alone, but I'm sitting there, and we're asking questions. So, Bobby, you made this great movie called Raging Bull, where you're a boxer, and you had to get in shape to be a boxer. Like, what'd you eat for breakfast? You know, what was your morning routine? How'd you do it? What he would say was fascinating and so interesting. And then the light bulb goes on, and I was like, I'm a director right now. Like, I'm standing next to a camera. I'm asking talent questions. I'm directing. This is kind of fun. And so, you know, I'd been there for a number of years, and then I secretly started soaking up information. Like, I would ask the camera guy, like, so what camera are you using? What kind of lens is this? What's the aperture, the ISO, or how do you dial in the white balance? And, lighting, sound, you know, so all of it I sort of secretly soaked up for another couple of years until I felt like I could be dangerous enough just to do it on my own. And eventually that's why I decided to branch out, leave Universal and start my production company.
You know, it's interesting as you were talking about that story with talking to the cameraman and figuring things out, it goes back to kind of that pattern you talked about when you were younger, just that the desire to try and figure things out, right? You had to figure things out on your own because of your childhood and how that's played out for you. And you could see it right there too. Like you see yourself as a director and you inherently think, I got to figure out all the things that are part of being a director. Because again, not knowing what the end game was going to be, you just started seeing all those pieces together and you just had a desire to know more and to figure things out. So you can see that pattern there.
It's true. And I feel sometimes I have imposter syndrome for a few seconds. You know, I don't let it bother me very much. But I think what's been consistent in my entire life and career is that I'm wholly unqualified to do most of the things I do at first. But, you know, I learn how to do it. Yeah. And I don't do anything that I don't feel capable of figuring out. I don't like to overpromise. I do like to overdeliver, but I'm certainly not afraid to like roll up my sleeves, get my hands dirty, figure it out, make mistakes. Yeah. And I've just become very accustomed to making mistakes, that kind of fail fast mentality, and then still being able to come back and fight another day. Like, don't fall too far.
Yeah.
Seth Godin gave me, you know, some of the best advice when he said, the person who fails the most wins.
Yeah.
But what's built into that notion is that you're able to come back another day.
Yeah.
The people who really fail are those who fail too far that they can't come back. That's like a, you know, they die.
Yeah.
They literally jump out of the airplane without the parachute. And it's like, you don't get a second shot at that.
Yeah.
Or the people who lose are also people who just don't try.
Yeah.
So if you say failure is not an option, that's a lie, right? You're usually either hiding or, you know, something's not working the right way.
Yeah, you're not taking enough risk because failure is inevitable at some point.
You have to have it.
Yeah. So your time at Universal comes to an end. You know, you've been scratching that director itch, getting all that information you need. Do you leave Universal to start your own thing?
Yeah.
And so, what year was this and what was that venture?
That year, my boss left Universal as well and went to Disney. And he asked me to come with him for a year to kind of help build out that department. In those days, it was called Disney Interactive. And this was like right around 2004, 2005. Okay. And right about that time, too, a little website called YouTube launches. and this gave me...
I wonder what happened to that site. Huh, interesting.
Yeah, it got kind of popular. But what it did for me was it really a signal that the playing field had been leveled. Because up to that time, I wasn't sure how I was going to go about what I was going to do. I just knew that that's what I wanted to do, that I had gotten some skills. I felt confident enough to do it. I didn't really have an action plan or any business. Yeah. it was really terrible planning to think about it. But the one thing that I did feel good was, you know, up to that point, I felt like, okay, I have to be sort of like J.J. Abrams. I've got to, you know, have a rep and I've got to, you know, have a big studio and I've got to do this and it's going to cost that. I've got to have this much investment. And then when YouTube launched, like all that went away. The barriers to entry went down.
Yeah.
And everything came down with it. Like prices of cameras came down and everything, all the barriers to entry sort of, you know, diminished. I got really even more excited at the possibilities. The money was great at Disney. And I was technically there as a consultant, and I stayed for 2 years.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Because the money was so good. And in between that, I had other little side hustles and side gigs. Like a little known fact is that in my college days, I was fascinated with Asia, and I actually did a study abroad, and I was in Japan. And I fell in love with Japan. I still speak a little bit of Japanese to this day. So one of my side hustles in between is I opened like a little language school. And I really built it around the expat business. So expatriates who are here from other countries, specifically Japan.
Okay.
And I set up shop like in the Torrance area. At the time, there was Honda, Toyota, and Nissan.
Yeah.
And there was a ton of Japanese expats there. And so I had contracts with all the car companies. And we did a great little business helping with culture and language. And that afforded me to travel back to Japan and meet some of the executives there.
Yeah.
And then we got some other video business through that. And we did a lot of like focus group stuff. And that really helped get the ball rolling for other kind of business opportunities as well.
So when you're consulting with Disney, at the same time, you're growing this media company. It's Good Brain Media, correct?
Yeah, it's called Good Brain Digital Studios.
Good Brain Digital Studios. So you're growing Good Brain Digital Studios at this time while you're with Disney. And you're starting off with the focus groups, the brand side of things. What did you want it to be?
Yeah, I was growing it into a production company that made commercials.
Okay.
I had a ton of experience in big budget brand marketing and strategy. Mm-hmm. At Universal, I'd worked with cross-promotional partners like Toyota or Marriott, mm-hmm. or all the CPG style, you know, consumer packaged goods folks. We did a ton of business with them. I knew everything about, you know, TV, media, radio, outdoor, you know, our division did all, you know, every bit of advertising that you can think of. So I sort of felt like I had all this experience, and now that I had lights, camera, action, I wanted to do commercials.
Yeah.
And I wasn't thinking I would do a Super Bowl commercial right out of the gate. So we started small, and we would do things for, you know, big and small brands, and and try and build a reputation and try and figure out our path. And during those years, you know, digital and the internet became more and more popular, and eventually it evolved into digital plus social. Mm-hmm. And we just saw a big opportunity. And as I saw, you know, what was happening in the town that I left, which was Burbank, mm-hmm. basically, which is a studio town, everyone was either a writer, director, producer, or actor, or they worked for the labor union, you know, building sets or something. Yeah. And I was like, you know what? You know, that is a tough game, because everyone's, you know, shooting. They got to get their script sold. They got to make a movie. And that's big budget. Like, the reason I moved my production company from Burbank down to Orange, back to Orange County, was because I wanted to be a bigger fish in a smaller pond. Mm. You know, I saw lots of opportunity. Orange County, you know, and Southern California in general, there's so much opportunity, so many great companies, you know, between Los Angeles and San Diego and everyone in between. I was like, we've got to be able to build this business on the brands that are down here. Yeah. And there's tons of milk and cookies to be had. So that was the plan.
So 05 is probably when you started on your own completely, correct? No longer consulting with Disney?
No, I would say 07.
07.
Yeah, I was really untethered by 07. And so my master plan was to, you know, go 100% into this venture, even kind of tapering off the side gigs and side hustles. And I sold the language school business and completely, you know, focused my attention on building the production company. And this was ramping up into, you know, September, October, November of 2007.
Got it.
So I don't know where you were in 2008.
I lost everything in 08, which is where I was leading to, about you starting a business in 2007.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about that.
Well, I'm very visual. Mm-hmm. And The Perfect Storm came out, you know, during the time I was in the movie business.
Yeah.
That was me. I was that little boat, you know, up that wave.
Yeah.
It was The Perfect Storm. Everything crashed on me.
Yeah.
All the plans that I had made, all the plans that I had made basically went away.
Yeah.
All the offers I had, all the deals we had in place, everyone had to pull back because budgets were getting slashed. People were losing their jobs like crazy. Now, I was really scared, but on the one hand, I was also really grateful because I left a really good job on my terms. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, out of that 250 people, I mean, I don't want to say 200, but close to it, probably lost their jobs unwillingly.
Yeah.
Got the rug pulled out from under them. So I was happy that I made the choice by accident to leave when I did. But it was really scary. And so as I was having my scary moment,
Well, let's pause for a second there.
Okay.
Because, you know, for a lot of listeners, they remember that time period. Again, for myself, I lost everything. My business shut down. And I'll share more in my story in episode 10. But what was that for you? That was the storm. You're on this boat climbing uphill on this wave. It's scary. What was it for you?
It's the people that relied on me. So I'm married. Mm-hmm. At the time, we had 4 children. Mm. We still have 4 children, but we had 3 and we just had our 4th that year. And, you know, we had a house and all the things that come with it. I wasn't really strapped. Like I didn't overbuy and I didn't have a lot of debt, but still it was scary. It's like, okay, I honestly can't tell you how I'm going to make the mortgage next month. I don't know how it's going to happen. And me going back to, you know, even my earliest days, when I went through all that divorce and and that was really traumatic for me. At the very least, I pride myself on being super resilient. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it wasn't difficult. I'm not saying it hasn't affected me, but I've always been able to bounce back. I think it's Babe Ruth quote. He said, you know, you can't beat someone who never gives up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I don't give up. I may get knocked down. I may get bloodied, but I'm always going to come back. At least that's my intention. Yeah. And so the scary part actually wasn't for me. It was for everyone who was looking at me like, what do we do?
Yeah.
How do we buy groceries?
You know,
how do we make the mortgage? My wife is, I would say, definitely my better half, but she's a realist. Right? Mm-hmm. I'm an optimist, and she's a realist. I don't mind uncertainty because I've lived with it my whole life.
Yeah.
Hey, your dad and I are splitting up. Oh, hey, you're moving to live with your grandparents. Oh, splitting up again.
Yeah.
You're changing schools.
Yeah.
We're moving again 12 more times.
Yeah.
You know, like I got used to uncertainty and things changing. Contrast that with my wife. She lived in the same house that her dad was born in.
Oh, wow.
And his dad bought the four corner houses in Huntington Beach where her dad's brothers and sister lived. And they all like basically, so they didn't move.
It was very stable.
Stable, deep roots. Yeah. So when all this turmoil came along, it was difficult, I think, for everyone else.
Yeah.
And difficult for me because I felt responsible for putting him on this hellish roller coaster that we are all on now together.
Yeah. This is one of the things I love about the startup story is there's so much that we, until we stop to reflect on our, you know, early days, there's so many patterns that we can see that really just, while they might have sucked in the early days, they set us up for certain things in the future, like the ability to adapt and in the midst of just chaos and uncertainty, and the resiliency that that helped develop in you for this. So how did you respond in those years of financial crisis of 07, 08, when everything was crumbling around everywhere? How did you weather that storm? Because now Good Brain Digital Studios is a successful company. How did you weather those years?
I put my head down, I rolled my sleeves up, and I just went to work. And I literally grinded it out, gutted it out, and I did whatever I could. I want to share, you know, I have a show.
Yeah.
And the show I do, I get to—
And that show is Behind the Brand.
It's called Behind the Brand,
and we'll have a link for it in the show notes because it's an incredible show.
Oh, well, thanks. One of the amazing privileges of doing that show is getting to rub elbows with people who are way smarter than me. And that's sort of my intent is like, I want a little bit of their fairy dust to rub off on me. And so it's very common for me to recall things that I've learned from each person over the years, as we're even talking, because I think they deserve credit. Like I'm definitely stood on the shoulders of others to get to where I am. Tony Robbins comes to mind when you talk about adversity. And something he told me that really stuck was, yes, adversity can shape you and help prepare you for things to come, or it can crush you if you let it.
Yeah.
And it's usually binary like that. Mm-hmm. Either you sink or you swim.
Yeah.
And so in my case, fortunately, I wasn't willing to sink. All I could do was swim. That was my only option forever, mainly because I had these four little kiddos, you know, a new baby at the time who were depending on me. My wife wasn't working at the time. In fact, she hasn't worked officially for someone else since we got married. Childcare is expensive and we decided to go that route. She's very smart and she's now got a little business I can talk about later. But so how did I get through it? I gutted it out. And we actually benefited from the recession. And I remember I hated that word, the recession. And I also hated in this economy, that phrase, which I heard a lot. Well, in this economy, you know, we just don't have, we just can't do it. But that actually helped us out because a lot of the other production companies in my space, whether it was LA or Orange County or wherever, they had a lot of overhead. They did invest in the studio and they could really only afford to do big budgets where like, I could easily whittle my team down to me if I had to. And I had contractors, right? Yeah. But like everything was made to order. So do I need two guys on this or do I need five or 12? Like it was project by project. And because I was so nimble and so flexible and willing to literally do any kind of video project that you wanted me to do, you know, as long as it was in line with my values, I would do it. And I just socked money away. And so doing all that and being so flexible and scrappy really helped us garner a reputation, gain reputation, and get the, I think we in turn helped out a lot of people who didn't have any budget. We could you know, do a lot with a little.
Yeah.
And after doing that for 2008, 9, 10, even into 11, those people, those clients came back and back, you know, kept coming back to us and rewarding us with more work. And so I think probably I could credit a bad economy to helping us float to the top when a lot of others lost their shirts and went out of business.
Yeah, it was definitely an ugly time for sure. But man, what an encouragement to all those listening. Just, I mean, that was such a bad time. And to hear, you know, yourself growing a digital studio in the midst of all that, it is absolutely possible with resilience to get through that storm, storms like that, to fall and get back up. And even with the responsibility of a mortgage and kids and everything else, just to keep grinding through. So what an incredible journey you just took us through in those years.
Well, there's two other takeaways for me personally. And that is, market conditions, although you should pay attention to them, really don't matter. Mm. A lot of people have made their fortunes, if you look back through history, when the economy was at its worst, right? A lot of these iconic, you know, Rockefellers and all these guys, they saw when there was an opportunity and they doubled down on it. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't have the means to double down on it, but in a way, I did double down on what I could, which was my time and my IP, right?
Yeah.
I definitely doubled down on that, and I over-delivered so that I could have a payday 3, 4, 5 years from now.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that market conditions can, you know, affect your outcome. I think you can do the best with what you've got and you can succeed in, at least that's how I feel. Having gone through that perfect storm, and it was arguably about as it can get.
Yeah.
If I can do that through that, it's given me the confidence to do anything now.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, this, you mentioned this group linked Orange County that I built.
Yeah.
I built a couple different communities at the time. I built one called the Action Sports Network.
I remember that as well.
Which was made up of action sports people and brands and influencers. And then I built Linked Orange County, which was for everyone else, but was hyper-focused on geography if you lived in Orange County. But the reason I did that is because I was trying to, again, you know, solve my own problem, scratch my own itch. I felt incredibly disconnected from everything that I had at the studio, right? At the studio, I had someone picking up my dry cleaning. Mm-hmm. I had a car allowance. You know, I could fly to New York and, you know, the travel company booked it. I had everything. I had a PR, you know, I had all this. And then I jumped to the dark side and I had none of it. And I just felt disconnected from people, resources, information, assets, everything.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, well, I need people and I want to surround myself with great people. And so that was me, you know, reaching out to my small little network and saying, I'm going to build this little group. I don't know what the purpose is, of it is yet. I don't want to monetize it. Like, it's not going to be my business. I'm certainly not an event producer or in the event business. And yet, despite saying that, I started organizing these events every single month.
Yep, I remember those.
And we would bring in, you know, I thought, well, gosh, South by Southwest wasn't really a thing at the time. It wasn't really on people's radar, but, you know, going to these big conferences was. And I thought, I don't have the budget for that. I can't take off a week or 2 weeks, you know, to schlep out somewhere in New York or wherever. Like, what if we had some of these awesome people come to us? And so I started reaching out and bringing people like Gary Vaynerchuk or Simon Sinek, you know, whoever, you know, is coming to town. And we'd host these events and they were amazing and people would get inspired. And then really awesome things would happen. Just, you know, these happy accidents, right?
Yeah.
And it was electrifying. Like, it lit me up for sure. Like, I loved being in front of an audience. I loved connecting people. I loved seeing other people benefit from what I was doing with no agenda, right? Like, just put good people in a room and see what happens, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how that kind of got started.
And that helped carry you through that season of life as well, right?
Well, to be honest, no.
Oh, okay.
Running those communities was not profitable, but that was my choice.
Yeah.
I really just tried to break even if we had any expenses.
Got it.
Or roll whatever surplus there was into producing the next event.
Okay.
To me, it was a little bit like the early Zuckerberg model, which was, don't worry about how to make money. Just like get people's attention first, get people together first, and then, you know, the attention becomes the asset. And so that was how I designed the community. Like, let's get people together. Let's get people, you know, online and offline in real life. Put them in a room together. have, you know, people coming to speak, and let's see what happens.
Yeah.
I think if I would have done it with more of a business goal in mind, it could have been very profitable, especially at the time, mm-hmm. because no one else was really doing events, especially to the degree and quality with speakers, for example, yeah. that I was doing them. But it was not my intention. I did not want to be in the event business. I didn't enjoy the process of
yeah.
putting it together. I yeah. liked being there.
Yeah.
Everything else was terrible, though. yeah.
When did Behind the Brand become... I mean, from the outside, it looks like it's a very significant brand to you, to the Good Brain Digital Studios. Is it as significant to you as a brand as it is for the viewer?
For sure. I think that was a happy accident too. So about that same time in around 2009, I was at the time just focused on where I lived mm-hmm. in Southern California. And then it occurred to me that, you know, the people that I was bringing in had, you know, national fame. People like Seth Godin
yeah.
and others. And I was like, hey, this is interesting. I should maybe think bigger than just where I'm at and maybe think about expanding it into a show since I've got the ability to do so. And again, it was all about sort of solving my own problem, which was how do I become successful immediately?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
because I really need to pay my mortgage yeah. next month.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to know. So I produced the show very selfishly. I asked all the questions that I wanted to know so that I could figure things out.
That's extremely intelligent of you.
Well, and it's lucky that everyone who was watching sort of seemed to want to know the same thing. And so that show started to get some traction. And as the wheels turned and sort of expanded, I expanded, you know, the brand into include, you know, people, influencers. Mm-hmm. So we have several different, it's very eclectic, you know, authors and athletes, yeah. musicians yeah. and entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. but it's still undefined, right? You know, Seth would argue with me that I'm not a brand, I'm a human being, but it's, you know, your brand is your brand, right?
Yeah.
It's what you promise and the things that you do that define you. So yeah, the show has just grown slowly, running the tortoise's race over, I guess, the last 9 years now.
Yeah.
And now we have syndication partnerships with big publishers, and we're trying to find new distribution all the time. But yeah, I love doing it. We do it all editorial, so we'd never do pay-to-play, for example. A lot of people have offered us lots of money to tell their story, and we have tried to keep it 100% on the other side of the wall for lots of different reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as you start getting paid to do editorial, then basically you're in the business of publishing people's press releases.
Yeah.
And that doesn't sound very fun to me.
Yeah.
you know, back to being a writer and storyteller, like I want to tell the stories that I want to tell, and I want to pick the people that I'm interested in, who I also think my audience is interested in, so that we can provide value to these struggling entrepreneurs yeah. and small business owners
yeah.
like I am.
Yeah.
And I also think the show is sort of unique. So there's back when I was doing, when I started in like 2009, 2008, 2009, there weren't a lot of players in the space. Guy Raz didn't exist, and he wasn't doing what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Neither was Tim Ferriss or, you know, the, you know, half a dozen other people who are doing it now who do it really well. I still think the difference between me and some of those other folks is most of those other people are millionaires who have built other businesses
yeah.
and either gotten bored or they have some extra free time. They're like, you know what? I'm going to do a podcast.
Yeah.
You know, like Reid Hoffman or something,
yeah.
right? Like, or, you know, I'm going to create a show. I think what makes what I do uniquely different is that I'm literally in the trenches with my audience. Like the struggle is real. Every day.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to figure out how to pay my mortgage next month.
Yeah.
And I still don't have it figured out. But I think that makes me uniquely qualified to ask the kinds of questions that my audience wants to know, because I still feel the pain.
Yeah.
And then having one foot in journalism as the editor and the journalist, I also have a foot in the other country because I have real life business experience. You know, I've done startups.
Yeah.
I've worked for a company. I've been employed. You know, I've collected yeah. a salary. I know how to speak brand because, you know, I was a brand guy.
Yeah.
I know how to speak agency because, you know, I worked a little bit with agencies and work in agencies. So I think I have a very kind of unique, interesting background that is different from all the other people who are doing the same kind of thing in my space, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So if behind the brand, it absolutely makes 100% sense. And I could probably add to that list many different points, what makes that your show different than other things out there. Obviously, because you are someone who's still in the grind like we all are, I think that is definitely some connection there with the audience. But you started it in a period where cash was tight, yet you leveraged freelancers for production, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so, but yet you weren't, it was not a pay to play. And so that is a decision most people probably wouldn't make in the midst of some very cash tight situations. Why did you decide, you know what, we don't have a massive pipeline of paid gigs. We're going to start behind the brand. What was it about that, and why did you make that decision? Because I think it's bold. I think it's brilliant. But at the same time, it's not one that I don't think a lot of people would have made in 08, 09.
Yeah. Well, I credit Seth Godin again. Seth wrote this book called Tribes right around that time. Mm-hmm. And it was about, you know, the opportunity to lead, whether that's, you know, lead in your social group at your church or synagogue, or, you know, in your business group when you're playing golf or whatever, or if you happen to have an email list of like 50,000 people like I do, or I, you know, did when I was running LinkedIn Orange County and all that, people paid attention. The attention is the asset. And he also told me, be careful not to get in a race to the bottom, because you just might win. and I really took that to heart. And I saw pandering for stories, you know, getting paid as a race to the bottom. It's like pretty soon, this is going to be a commodity thing, and I'm basically going to be working for them.
Yeah.
Like, that's BS. I don't want to be in that game. Like, I want to maintain creative control. Mm. If I think a story is good, no matter who it is, big or small, whatever, I want to do it.
Yeah.
And so I resisted, what's that marshmallow test, you know, that is famous in psychology. They give the four-year-old a choice. They give him a marshmallow, and they say, you can have this right now if you eat it. Or if you wait 15 minutes, I'll give you a second one.
Yeah.
I'm very much someone who would wait for that second marshmallow. I don't need instant gratification.
Okay.
Again, going back to my, you know, gritty days of survival, I feel like I'm a survivor in many ways. I'm willing to gut it out and sacrifice.
Yeah.
I don't mind a little pain. I don't mind, you know, getting beat up a little bit, waiting for the payoff. And so that was my mindset is, okay, eventually when I get the attention, that's going to be the asset. And then I can monetize it. Mm. And, you know, and it's taken years to do that. But now we have sponsors. You know, this episode is brought to you by, you know, Veridesk. You know, Jason's one of our sponsors.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, okay. He's terrific. And we have many others who help support the show in that way. And so we're able to do the editorial with one company and then find a sponsorship who wants to pay and, you know, reach our audience, is a completely separate, different company.
Yeah.
We never cross the streams, as they say.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So what else is Good Brain Studios doing in addition to Behind the Brand?
Yeah, so I think of it in like four buckets. So bucket number one is like film and commercial work. So I'm a very active director. We're producing our own commercial stuff for other brands, but I also, you know, will go and I'll get called onto a set, someone else's set, and I'll direct a commercial or do something. Yeah. The second bucket is like original content. So we're developing original stuff for social, or we're developing a web series for someone, or we're doing a campaign. The sky's the limit when it comes to video. It's 365 video mixed in with strategy and all that. The other part that we're doing is we're doing a lot of channel management. So we're taking other people's like YouTube channels, for example, we're managing it and optimizing it for search. In some cases, we're doing everything where we're creating the content, we're uploading, we're publishing, we're setting a content calendar for them. And other times we're just manning the dials.
Yeah.
And that's an area where it's become very interesting in the last 3 or 4 years, where we are on the constant lookout for new talent, whether they are someone like Cesar Millan, who's the dog whisperer, or, you know, we've worked with Cesar and we've worked with like Jillian Michaels, who's a fitness person. And so we're always looking for great talent who've got the right IP, some sort of deep domain knowledge in something, whether that's fitness or health or dog training or, you know, whatever your deep domain knowledge is. And then we can help build content around that IP.
Okay.
And then find a place for it to live, and we host it and do all that. Okay. And then the fourth piece is full-length documentary films. So
that's right. You had a Kickstarter recently.
Yeah, we did something with Indiegogo, and I'm actually working on two active full-length documentary films. One is a client project. It's based in Portland. And then the other one is my own passion project. And so I've committed to do one full-length feature documentary film every year.
Oh, okay.
So we're always looking for new projects and you know, trying to vet good stuff from bad stuff, yeah, and figure out what to do next year and all that.
What do you see for yourself in the next 3 years?
I would love to do more of the same. Behind the Brand has become a great way for us to meet great people. Mm-hmm. It's been an amazing opportunity to get FaceTime with just some incredible minds,
yeah,
and learn a ton. But it's also opened a ton of doors, which have led to other, you know, like film and commercial work. Like someone saw one of my shows, and we ended up doing a commercial for Microsoft, you know,
okay,
Microsoft Office. And, you know, that was a big budget and we did that. It was great. But they found me because they saw one of my, yeah, my episodes. Or, you know, we're finding more and more of these folks that want to develop their own content, want to do their own channel. And so we're helping them sort of white label that and be the production company behind that. And then we're doing a lot of collaborating with the films too. So I love what I do. I'm trying to widen my lane, but also stay in my lane. Yeah. So it's all about, you know, brand marketing and strategy and video production. And trying to really focus on what I do best, which is, you know, stay creative. And I'm very much an idea guy, so I like to always have my hands in the things and contributing to that.
You know what's interesting in our time together, it is very apparent how intentional you are about the things that you do. The idea of staying in your lane and knowing your four buckets, the why would you build Behind the Brand during a really rough economic season. And all of it is about knowing what it is you want, being patient in that time, because you said you don't need to play for instant gratification, which is extremely uncommon. And I think all of those things have led to the success that you've attained so far in your career, and obviously is going to bode well for you, you know, in the years to come as you keep pushing into that. So I just, it is incredibly impressive to see the level of intention you have with everything that you do.
Well, thanks. I still, it's limited success. I feel like I'm this work in progress, but you're right. I am very intentional and I do feel very strategic about most things, although I still am flexible enough to try things that might not work, as Seth would say, as long as the risk measures up to the reward.
Yeah.
Right. And that's sort of how I measure everything. It's funny because I had a conversation with my daughter about this and she thought that I love to take risk. you know, you've done all these entrepreneurial ventures and you're this entrepreneur. I said, well, I actually don't like to take risk. And I think I can't speak for everyone, but it seems this way with everyone. And that is, as an entrepreneur, what you're trying to do is mitigate risk. Mm-hmm. There's a chasm and you're trying to close the chasm so that instead of this great leap of faith that you may die doing, it's more like a little hop, right? And so you're trying to be strategic or make intelligent decisions as much as possible, right? To make good choices so that you can, again, if you fail, you can come back and fight another day.
Yeah. You know, to add to that picture though, I think what makes entrepreneurs unique is just the willingness to take risks with uncertainty. You might mitigate it. You might try to reduce as much risk as possible, but you're still willing to. Like you're still willing to take a risk at some point versus the stable job or employment. What would you say? I mean, you've definitely, I mean, as we're talking, I can see many different stages of your journey. You know, to our listeners that may be pondering entrepreneurship for themselves because they just have this itch or this desire to do something more, or the entrepreneurs that have tried before and failed numerous times and fallen, or the entrepreneur that just doesn't have the success they had hoped for. I mean, what do you say to those people? And as now we spend an hour or so reflecting on your journey, what do you say to those people?
Whew, I mean, we could spend another few hours talking about that. to give you the short version, you know, there's a term, starving artist. right? And you're a starving artist for a reason. It's because likely, well, there's possibly two problems, one or two. And that is you're making art for the wrong people. Mm-hmm. Maybe your art's amazing, but you're making it for the wrong people and they don't appreciate you. Mm. Or your art is not as good as you think it is. And so therefore you're a starving artist. So my advice is if you're going to try something new, you know, unconventional or entrepreneurial, whatever you want to call it, is that you really focus on the intersection of what you love to do and what you're great at. Mm. The intersection of what you love to do and what you're great at. Because when you do that, you will find your audience eventually, right? If you're really good at something, you know, that art is eventually going to make its way into someone's house and you're going to get paid for it. And if you love doing it, you'll never quit because every day just is amazing. When the opposite, right? Like you're really great at accounting, but you hate accounting. that's not going to scale. That's not going to last very long.
Yeah.
You're going to, bad things are going to happen.
Yeah. I love how when everyone wants to describe the thing that people hate to do, it's the accounting is by default the position.
Sure.
You know, as we wrap, close this conversation out, one, I'm so thankful again for the time that you've afforded me and my listeners to hear your journey and all the things that we can learn from it. In addition to that gratitude, I'm a firm believer that if we forget the shoulders that we've stood upon or the people that have contributed to our success or our journey, if we forget them and lose that bit of gratitude, it's going to lead to our failure at some point in time. When you look back at your journey and from all the way from beginning to till now, who do you look back as just key contributors to your success that you just are forever grateful for what either that small thing they said or that big thing they've done or whatever it is that they have contributed to your success, who are those people?
Too many to count. And it's funny, I'm smirking as you say that because I'm thinking of Snoop Dogg. Snoop Dogg just got his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And he gave a speech that just cracked me up, which I feel a little bit in my heart, but I'll qualify it. He said, I want to thank me for all the hard work that I do. And I want to thank me for never giving up on me. And I want to thank me for believing in me when no one else did. And I feel like that all the time. Mm-hmm. I really feel like I did this. I made it happen because no one else was up late thinking about me when I was screwed. And I kind of screwed myself, right? But sometimes you are a victim of circumstance. And the most important thing you can do is what you do after that, right? So that said, if I've had 400 people, 500 people on my show, I'd like to thank each one of those 500 guests, from Tony Robbins to Seth Godin to Gary Vaynerchuk to Laird Hamilton to Tony Hawk to, and not just the famous people, not just name dropping, but there's all the 500 people in between too who are running businesses, big and small, who I've had the privilege to talk to and learn from. I've learned something from every single person. And I try to take what I think I can implement into my life.
Yeah.
And if that saying is a Jim Rohn who gets credited for, you are the sum total of the people you hang around. If that's true, at some point I'm going to be pretty amazing because I've talked to some amazing and hung out with some amazing people, if only for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
What impresses me most about Brian's story is his refusal to accept market conditions as a barrier to his success. Even more so, I love that he took risks during such an economically challenging time. While most people were not willing to take on any work that did not have an invoice attached to it, he decided to build a major video series that now has distribution through some of the largest entrepreneurial channels available, like Inc. Magazine and Fast Company. Behind the Brand is now watched by millions of people, and it all started as a risk that he took. I have so much respect for Brian because he did not allow the surrounding circumstances or the critics and naysayers to have a voice in his dreams and pursuit. You see, the people that are critical of you are people that are not willing to take risks themselves, right? You get what I'm saying here? Think about that. Those of us that have taken chances and risks to accomplish something big are not going to tear down someone else who thinks big like we do. We want to offer advice and wisdom to help them avoid some of the pitfalls that we ran into. Those that have never risked anything are the ones that will be the first to be critical of you. So now, let me ask you this. If you believe what I'm saying to be true, then why would you give those critics, those non-risk takers, those naysayers, those that play it safe, why would you give them any type of say in your effort to build your dreams? I heard this quote once, and I believe it was from Dave Hollis, that said, "Why give the people in the cheap seats a front row ticket to your dreams?" I hope that shifts your perspective a bit. So what narrative do you have in your mind right now that is stopping you from starting your story? DM me on Instagram and let me know. Let's get real with each other. DM me on Instagram at thestartupstory.co. Let's keep this dialogue moving a bit. Now, if you've been around the Startup Story for a few episodes, then you know that I believe entrepreneurs help other entrepreneurs. With that in mind, go to Brian's channel on YouTube. It's youtube.com/behindthebrand and subscribe to Brian's channel. Again, youtube.com/behindthebrand. I mean it. Go subscribe right now. It costs you nothing but maybe 30 seconds of your time to support a fellow entrepreneur. In fact, if you just go to our show notes, you'll see a link in the channel for easy access. It's so simple to support those that think like us, those that pursue big dreams like us, and those that provide real value to us. So please, youtube.com/behindthebrand, subscribe right now. The Startup Story community has been so incredible with sharing our podcast with others. But we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We are a startup, and the most powerful way you can support the Startup Story podcast is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at thestartupstory.co. Share the Startup Story on your social media, either with a link or a screenshot. Make sure you tag or mention us at thestartupstory.co so we can see your help and say thank you for it. And lastly, share the podcast on your LinkedIn profile. The Startup Story is for entrepreneurs, so please do not underestimate the power of sharing the Startup Story on your LinkedIn profile so other entrepreneurs can discover us. In fact, most people struggle to share good content on LinkedIn anyways, so if you want to support the Startup Story, then search for the Startup Story company page, follow us, and share our posts to help encourage other founders and spread the word about the podcast. Every single founder has a story, and the startup stories we bring to you every week can encourage and inspire another founder. It might just be what they needed to hear to keep moving forward on their dreams. I look forward to sharing these stories every Tuesday with hopes to inspire you to start your story.